Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff. Today, host Latara Smith talks with David Robinson about his case of wrongful conviction, the court ruling that set him free, and its significance for others, such as Ricky Kidd and Keith Carnes. Then, host Elisa Breitenbach talks with Stephen Howe about his book, The Deprived, Innocent on Death Row. It is an investigation of the American justice system and cases of the wrongfully convicted on death row. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Up next is Latara and her guest.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to KKFI 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Latara Smith of the Casey Freedom Project. And this morning, I have the privilege, the blessed privilege, to be able to interview Mr. David Robinson. Mr. Robinson, are you on the line?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, you know what? Thank you so much for coming on this, Mr. Robinson, with me this morning. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to do so. I'm going to just do a little brief introduction as to who you are, and then I want you to immediately come in and explain the injustice that happened to you. Everyone, David Robinson was one of many individuals here in Missouri who were innocent and wrongly convicted. And as a result of his wrongful conviction, Mr. Robinson served approximately 18 years in prison for a murder that he most definitely did not commit. Mr. Robinson, let me ask you something. Were you sentenced, did your case fall out of Scott County? Because I noticed that Sykeson is divided by two counties. Did you fall out of Scott County?
In Scott County, correct.
Okay, so your wrongful conviction came out of Scott's County. And, you know, a lot of people here on our end in Kansas City, you know, down on this end, because your case was so well advertised in the media down near Sykeson and the St. Louis area, which you're from Sykeson, Missouri, and this is actually where this crime, supposedly crime, happened. But the area that your wrongful conviction fell out of. So many people here on our end in Kansas City most definitely don't know about your wrongful conviction unless they've seen it shared on social media like Facebook, groups like myself and the Casey Freedom Project and other groups who kind of advocate and fight for those who are innocent, wrongly convicted, most definitely shared your story. But as far as people in our community that may not have access to Facebook or may not, you know, be in those wrongful convictions group, most definitely don't know about your wrongful conviction. So can you tell us exactly what happened? How did you end up getting wrongly convicted and having to serve 18 years in prison for a crime that you did not commit?
I was arrested based off a tip of an informant. I was arrested on the first night that the crime happened, and I was released. And 3 weeks later, I was arrested again and charged with the first degree murder of Sheila Box, who I was wrongly convicted over. It was based off of informant as well as a jailhouse informant. The first informant was a paid informant. He was a drug addict.
Okay. And you know what? And I see that often. When we go to look at and break down wrongful investigations, you know, I see that often where the police officers or detectives or even some prosecutors have preyed upon individuals who were bound by drug addiction, or even some of the women that they've used to testify in some of these cases were bound by drug addiction as well as bound and, you know, really caught up into solicitation. And that they would use these people because a lot of times they had pending cases and they were pressured and forced and coerced into, you know, giving these false statements and participating all the way to the point where they're taking the stand and falsely testifying against someone, which ends up in their wrongful conviction. So what kind of happened in your case?
In my case, they used a confidential informant, which actually was a paid informant. But they testified that they were paying them in the witness protection program, which there is no paper trail or no such thing ever occurred. They, like you said, he was had pending charges. He admitted it. He admitted everything, but they filled in the blank line and said, well, he got an eyewitness. So once they sent him into the county jail, they also used another guy who testified. He heard me say that I committed the crime and I confessed to it. But yet, we proved this guy never was. He said he was my cellmate. He never was in the same cell with me. He was generally in the same block, but he testified that I said it in his presence. He was above me on the top bunk, which was a four-man cell.
Okay. Mr. Robinson, can I get you to kind of come closer to your phone because you sound just a little bit muffled?
Can you hear me now?
Talk up just a little bit more. We'll be able to hear you better.
All right. How about now?
That's better.
Okay. Anyway, they used the guy who said he was my cellmate, and we proved that he never was my cellmate. His testimony was he was coerced. It was fabricated to lend strength to the alleged eyewitness who said he seen me do it and placed me at the crime.
Okay. But, and who did he say coerced him? Did he say this was the acts of the police? Or did he say the prosecutor did this? Did he, you know, did the prosecutors know of this?
Well, you know, the prosecutor should have known of it, but I can't say that she did because they used a special prosecutor against me. But it's a proven fact that the lead detective that was on my case, which was Blakely, he said he had other guys in the county jail while I was being held that said the same thing, but yet he didn't interview them, and nor was they questioned or cross-examined on the stand. They just went along with the fact that the guy said that he heard me and I confessed and I was talking to other people, but if I was talking to someone, my defense was like, well, where's these people at? Can they confirm it?
But right.
These notes, like you said, this guy here was just brought back from a mental institution. He was schizophrenic, bipolar, and paranoid. And he tried to hang himself and he cut his wrist a few times. And he had a history of mental illnesses in and out of different mental institutions. But yet, they still put him on the stand and found him as a credible witness.
And you know what? I'm so glad that you brought that up because I've seen that often used too, where people who were mentally ill were preyed upon and, you know, they were used as witnesses and the prosecutors did not bring forth the fact, you know, make that known to the defense that they had pending cases. I've seen it a lot where people have had pending cases and prosecutors actually cut a deal with them in those pending cases and did not disclose those deals that they made with those individuals to the defense. And the people who they were testifying was sent on to prison. And then those people end up fighting for years to get out, to come back in, you know, under a Brady violation where the prosecutors, you know, because prosecutors are supposed to disclose. They're supposed to disclose information. They're supposed to let the defense know when they have made a deal with someone. And I promise you, I've seen so many times where that doesn't happen. I've also seen prosecutors purposely withhold an individual's complete criminal history. Okay, they may bring up one or two cases of that witness's criminal history. Now, they did that in Keith Carnes' case. They withheld the criminal histories of a few of the witnesses. And when we came back and found out, and wanted to address the issue and tried to address the issue with the fact that that was a Brady violation when you don't disclose the complete criminal histories, when you do not disclose that the prosecutors cut a deal with someone, okay? Those are Brady violations. So though we see that often, what we don't see often here in the state of Missouri is the prosecutors are not held accountable for their acts of prosecutorial misconduct. And many times the police officers are not held accountable for their acts of police misconduct. So my question to you, Mr. Robinson, in your case, because you were set free, you've been out, what, about 10 months now?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So has there been any disciplinary action taken towards the police in your situation who you know, basically set you up for this wrongful conviction or even for the prosecutors? Has there been any type of disciplinary, you know, actions taken towards them or their licenses?
Well, the lead detective, he was forced to resign.
Okay.
If you know the Supreme Court, it was a special master that the Supreme Court granted me. He found them incompetent and he violated so much. He violated my rights as well as violating the code of the and his job, his ethic work. It's based off the fact of mine. They resigned, like I said, and they fired him altogether at the end, based off it.
Right. And they very well should have. And what also needs to happen is, because even though he's been fired or he resigned or whatever the case may be, if he is still in the state of Missouri and no one went forth to bring forth any type of disciplinary actions to go towards taking his police, you know, his rights to be a police officer, because every police officer in the state of Missouri has what you call a peace officer license that is governed by Missouri. And if you can show that those police officers committed any type of felonies or did anything like in your situation or things that I saw them do in, I've heard that they did in Ricky Kidd's situation or things that I've heard them do in Keith Carnes or that I know they did in Keith Carnes' case, you know, you can go after those licenses and you can actually strip them of those peace officer licenses, making it where they cannot act or work as a police officer in the state of Missouri. They might can go somewhere else and try, but in the state of Missouri, they would not be able to do that. But many times people don't go to those extremes and take the next step to go after these police officers or even to foul against the prosecutors because, you know, they just either don't know about it or they just simply, once they're out of the rut that they were in, they're like, throw their hands up like, hey, I'm out. I'm glad to be out. I am not going to pursue this any further. So talking about your case, because I know we've kind of touched base now on how you ended up wrongly convicted. But I want to ask you this right here. You submitted several motions to the local courts there in your county and far before you went to the Supreme Court. Can you kind of explain to us the different steps and the different avenues that your attorneys went or even that you went pro se as you were representing yourself? Tell us about the steps you took before you actually, your case made it to the Supreme Courts.
Well, first I filed what they call would be a Form 40.
Okay.
This is where you appeal the decision of the judge or your appeal the decision of being found guilty by a jury or a judge. And from that point, I went on to file what they call a motion to that decision that that being denied. By me being in the Southern District, I had to go in the Southern District to file another appeal to the state decision, which was all denied. And they thought, you know, there was nothing done wrong because they were within law, so they say. And they turn around, I had to file what they call, I filed state habeas corpus in Mississippi County, which is prison I've been held in, Charleston, Missouri. So wherever prison you've been held in, that's the county you got to file in.
Right. And I just want to repeat that because you kind of went out. What he was saying is that whatever correctional facility an inmate is being held in, and if they file what's called a writ of habeas corpus or a Rule 91, they have to file that petition out of the jurisdiction where they're being held. So individuals at Crossroads have to file, if, for example, in DeKalb County, okay? So he had to file his Rule 91 in the county where he was being held in prison. That's what he was saying when the phone was kind of cutting in and out. So, Mr. Robinson, when you filed all of that, and let me go back and say this too, a Form 40, everyone has the right to file that form. And I think you filed that, what, within 30 days of being incarcerated? You have 30 days? Is that the time span 90. On that?
90
days. Okay. I know I was a little confused. I knew they had a set time. And I know timelines are very, very, very important because that's the only reason that Ricky Kidd is still held in prison is because of the simple fact that he missed a timeline. The state is not even arguing against this man's innocence. They're arguing about a doggone timeline. And that's absolutely crazy.
We say we hide behind it, call it a proceeding. They call it that you delayed.
Right.
You didn't know. They don't accept the fact that you didn't know, especially when you're doing pro se, which means doing it by yourself. They'll say you missed a timeline. They order me on the timeline. Like you said, they don't go out to the fact that they're not saying you're innocent. They're saying, well, procedurally barred is what they call it.
Right. When you try to bring up things and they say, oh, well, you can't bring that up. You're procedurally barred. So it you went through all of those steps, because this is what I want to make the people most definitely clear and understand. And this is why conviction integrity units are so important. OK, if your case would have been in Texas, where they have a legitimate, say Dallas County, Texas, where they have a, or Harris County, where they have legitimate conviction integrity units, you could have submitted your concerns, a package to that unit. You probably would have been out years before than the years that Missouri kept you caught up, because they would have addressed your wrongful convictions without you having to go through all those steps going all the way up to the Supreme Court, which is timely as well as very expensive. Now, you were blessed to have Brian Cave come on your case pro bono, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And, I mean, he has one of the biggest law firms. I mean, he's very well known. And I just take my hat off to him that he even, you know, had it in his heart to look into your situation and to take your case. And had it not been for his firm and the students at what university is that really helped you too? The students over there?
Washington University.
Exactly. If they had not taken interest in your case, Mr. Robinson, it's sad to say, but you would still be incarcerated.
Yes, ma'am.
You would most definitely still be incarcerated. And it's just, you know, it's wild to think that. And you know what? I see that here in Missouri. It's like here in Missouri, these counties in Missouri just do not want to right their wrongs. I know that is for sure about Jackson County and the prosecutor's office here in Jackson County, Missouri. They just simply do not want to right their wrongs. It's like they recover wrong until you can't cover it anymore. But in your situation, your case is a case that everyone, that many attorneys who are fighting wrongful convictions and things as such, your case is a case that attorneys were holding their cases up, sitting back, waiting and watching to see what the Supreme Court was going to do in your case. And so your case, because the Supreme Court did rule to let you out, because that's how you're out now to do this interview, amen? But I can tell you, your case is a door opener for so many men and women who are innocent and wrongly convicted here in the state of Missouri. Like, did you know that?
Yes, ma'am.
So you've paved the way for some people. So thank you for fighting. Thank you for getting in the law library and filing your Form 40s. And thank you for, you know, doing the pro se motions you did in the beginning. Even though you may not have known what to do and exactly how to do it, you still did it. And that's what I tell individuals when I go into the prisons. I say, listen, you guys have got to fight. Come off the rec yards. Come away from the domino tables. You know, I know some of the guys can hear me talking now. You know, get in those law libraries and try to figure out what is going on with your cases and what you can do to help yourself.
And also, you got to make sure if you were able and capable, you got to have outside help, because they had cases in the prison system. Like I've been told a few times by different guys, they don't have my case in the computer. When I was working on my cases in the library, they'll hide it. But you got to go and get it. Like the Amron, the Joseph Amron case, which was a high standard of clown. You got to prove, they say murder, or you got to prove actual innocent. But in my case, I superseded the whole thing. I proved actual innocent, factual innocent, as well as mean and unjust. They continue to hold me, incarcerate me for a crime that I did not commit, when you know that the truth was out there and the fact that I did climb that hurdle. So now they raised a bar with me on my case. The guy has been calling me, telling me they can't find it in the law library. And
you're correct, because I get those calls all the time. Miss Smith, can you help us to get, you know, a copy of David Robinson's paperwork, because we can't get it? And you're absolutely correct. It is not accessible to those men who are incarcerated, who are fighting their own cases. Your case has not been made accessible to those men. And I get a lot of those phone calls, because I'll get it many times and send it in to them. OK, and they've even given me problems when I send it in. They'll send it back out and says, oh, this is not legal mail. Send this back in 5 pages at a time. I've actually broke your motion down before. 5 pages at a time per envelope to send it back in to make sure that that individual received copies of your paperwork. So, you know, they do those. They play those little games, you know. But let me ask you something, Mr. Robinson. How did you actually get cleared? Was it DNA evidence? Was it physical evidence? What happened?
Basically, from the very beginning of my case, they did all the tests on me, gun residue, DNA, fingerprint, you name it, which never tied me or connected me to the crime at all. So I used the very same evidence at the end of my journey. Based off the fact that the Supreme Court appointed a special master who heard all the evidence that was put on, and he really paid attention and really went with the rule of the law. In fact, the detective that testified in the presence of this appointed judge that they appointed me to special master, he even was upset at the detective because of the fact he lied on the oath in front of him about certain things. And then there was things brought up and brought out that I didn't even know about. There was a change in the Sunshine Law, like you said, which was held back, and they never turned it over to me or the defense. But by the grace of God, I was blessed with Brian K. Law Firm, who really brought it. But I also got to give...
Well, I can tell you, and let me say this for the Sunshine Law, for those who are listening that may not know what that is. The Sunshine Law actually allows individuals to request their records. So like if you have a loved one who is in prison, they're fighting their cases and they want their paperwork, they want a copy of the police investigative file, or they want the prosecutor's file, or they want any records pertaining to their case, they can make that request through the Sunshine Law. Now, what I've seen happen is, of course, I've seen different things happen. I've seen them give records, but withhold and retain some of them. And I've even seen them say, we'll give you this. But, you know, I know Keith Carnes got a bill for like $350 for his records. And he actually paid that, not knowing that he didn't have to. But he did to get the records, and they weren't even complete records. I know that I've pulled records. And I tell the family members and I tell individuals, you know, they say, oh, well, my loved one has their records. I said, how long ago did they get them? 15, 20 years ago, however long they've been locked up. I say, you need to pull them again, because many times if there was someone in office or in place in that particular position who knew to withhold certain documents, or maybe was told to withhold certain documents, when you have a long amount of time that gone through, those individuals may not no longer be in that position. So the new person won't know what to withhold. So you're going to get some things that were withheld. And that's exactly what happened in Keith Carnes' case. I got things that he didn't know anything about. He had never seen it. And he requested it and got records and even paid for it. And they still did not give that man a complete copy, complete records of everything that he had. So you basically, what did the judge consider where he actually said, I'm going to let this man out of prison? What was the breaking point for that, for the Supreme Court, that they just said, you know what, we're going to let him out?
Well, in my opinion, I was released based off the fact of perjury testimony.
Okay.
False evidence. Because like you said, they had evidence, and you got to be, the evidence that you bring on, you got to say, in the absence of the evidence that was missing, misplaced or intentionally annoyingly or willingly. You just can't say that without proof. You got to go and prove it. But in chasing down the lead, I was led to other evidence, which was giving other evidence. But at the same time, it was the judge simply put overwhelming evidence that I shouldn't have been released
right
a long time ago.
Right. So was your case considered an actual innocence case, or was it a gateway? Basically, a gateway claim, they said.
My case is actually innocent as well as gateway, because it was overwhelming.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, we are actually nearing the end of our show, and I want to let you have these last couple of minutes. What would you say to individuals who are incarcerated, fighting wrongful convictions, and what would you say to their families? Because I know your mom is a great woman of faith, and I know that she protested a lot of things to help you. So in closing, what would you say to them?
I would say stay encouraged. Don't give up. And just, hang in there and keep pressing the issue, because I ran across a lot of guys that I know the legal work, know the law system. You have to stay encouraged. I mean, it's what I had to do. I had to keep pushing. My advice to the family and loved ones, believe in them and don't give up on them, because a lot of guys lose hope when their family give up on them. It tears them down. It makes them weak. I got a documentary that's coming out on Amazon on May 17th. I mean, please watch it if you're able to. It'll give you a lot more encouragement to really stick and show you that you need family and outside support.
And so your documentary film is coming out when?
May the 17th.
May the 17th. And I'm excited because I did see the one they did on you when you were incarcerated, where they actually went down to Sikeston and filmed a lot of stuff. And I'm excited about that. I'm excited about the new one coming out. And I'm sure that it's a big transition for you being out after being gone, you know, 18 years, having to put your life back together. I know that you're blessed. You have a wonderful, beautiful wife and you have a supportive family. So I know that things are coming together for you. And I really want to thank you, Mr. Robinson, for taking the time to interview with me today. And we just appreciate you coming on the show. Everyone, thank you for listening.
Now, the calendar for the week of March 25th. Veronica's Voice invites you to their annual celebration and fundraiser. In the words of survivors, joyfully looking towards the future. This evening of inspiration from poetry and short stories authored by survivors of commercial exploitation and performed by local artists will include drinks and dessert. It will be held Saturday, March 30th, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Meadowlark Event Center, 20650 West 191st Street, Spring Hill, Kansas. For more information and tickets, go to veronicasvoice.org. Mama on a Mission will be hosting their fifth annual fundraiser, Walk a Mile in My Shoes, Saturday, April 6th at Tower Park, 75th and Holmes, KCMO. The walk will begin at 11:30 a.m. and will be open to everyone that wants to make a difference in the community, with an emphasis towards assisting the needs of the families of homicide victims and violent crime. If you or your business would like to be a sponsor, contact Monique Willis at 816-499-1214 or email 4 mamaonamission@gmail.com. To register for the walk, go online to mamaonamission.myevent.com. Corey's Network invites survivors of murder to their weekly workshops to learn how to deal with grief, the media, investigations, court, and moving forward after a homicide has occurred. This is a workshop, not a grief group. The next workshop, What to Expect from the Investigation, will be held Monday, March 25th, at the Church of the Four Corners, 14300 East Highway 40, KCMO. The church is located east of the Hy-Vee on Highway 40 and Nolan Road. For more information and listings of future workshops, call 816-834-9161 or email coreysnetwork@gmail.com. My name is Jeff, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Up next is Elisa and her guest.
Good morning, everybody. This is Jaws of Justice, of course, and today we have a gentleman by the name of Stephen Ho, who has founded or co-founded more than five media companies over the past 10 years and has employed several hundreds of journalists and photographers and designers on a regular basis or on a freelance base. Stephen has written about numerous topics and told stories from different countries, but his main focus has always been on America. Today, we're going to be discussing his brand new book, The Deprived Innocence on Death Row, The Ultimate Punishment and the Dark Truths That Lie Behind the Death Penalty and the Great Miscarriages of Justice. Stephen has given faces to the innocent lives that have been touched and even some that have even been taken. Stephen, thank you for coming on our show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
I would just like you to go into how you came about to write this book, what made you do it, and all the lives that you actually wrote about are just absolutely amazing, gut-wrenching, jaw-dropping, just an incredible book for everyone to read.
Thank you very much. I was actually working on another book back in 2014 when I came across the idea of writing this book, The Deprived. I was writing a book about the 10 main challenges that the American society faces, as Americans would describe these challenges themselves. And one of these issues that I wrote about was injustice for the law. And I interviewed an exoneree by the name of Nick Yaris for this chapter. And I met him in Los Angeles in a restaurant, and I had expected to meet a man that would be broken by 22 years, wrongfully convicted and innocent on death row. I actually imagined that when he entered the restaurant, he would literally be crawling along the walls. Either that or he would be a man very hardened and brutal, brutalized by all these years behind bars. But I found him to be something completely different. He was a very kind, educated, and loving guy. And that took me by surprise, because I really couldn't grasp how can you spend 22 years on death row for a crime you've never committed, and then a few years later sit in a restaurant in Los Angeles and offer other people the kindness that society couldn't offer you. And that gave me the idea, because I was so surprised in a good way by the way that this gentleman conducted himself. And it gave me the idea to look into whether this was something that only applied to Nick Yaris, or if that was something that you could convey to other exonerees of death row. So I decided to look up a number of people who've been wrongfully convicted and put on death row to see how they have been able to restore their lives after exoneration or not. And that was how I came across the idea of writing this book.
Your book also goes into what has led up to these wrongful convictions and who's most likely to be incarcerated for a crime they've never committed. You want to talk about that?
Yes, sure. I would say that, in a very banal way, anyone could leave their house in the morning and not returning for dinner at night. Because some of the cases that I've looked into, they prove that the most innocent people in society who've never done anything wrong, not even, more or less gotten a speeding ticket, they end up in a sudden convicted of a crime for some very, at times, very banal reasons, and at others because someone has had the intent of framing them simply because of evilness. And if you look at the reasons for wrongful convictions at a more overall level, you'll find out that one of the reasons that leads to most wrongful convictions would be official misconduct. It would be false accusations. It would be misleading forensic evidence. It would be fabricated confessions, and naturally also mistaken eyewitness identifications and so on. And none of these different reasons will ever excuse that we even put innocent people on death row. But some of them are perhaps more to be understood than others. Well, we're only human beings, and naturally, some people will eventually give a false testimony based on a mistaken eyewitness identification, as an example. But when it comes to official misconduct, bad lawyering, and misleading forensic evidence, well, there really is no excuse for this leading to wrongful convictions. Because if you take a position, both as a lawyer on the side of the person on stand, and if you decide to become a prosecutor on the other side of the table, you are being trusted a very important task. And first and foremost, that task is to put the right person behind bars. But in some of these cases, and again and again and again, it has been proven that law enforcement officers, prosecutors, and so on, has been so eager on getting a conviction that it really didn't matter who they put behind bar as long as they put someone.
And it does happen in America quite often. And a gentleman that fascinates me is Richard Deiter, the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. And his comments are just go straight to the heart. Every time we have an execution, there's a risk of executing an innocent person. And the risk may be small, but it's unacceptable. And the great majority of innocent defendants who are convicted of capital murder in the United States are neither executed nor exonerated. They are sentenced or resentenced to prison for life and then forgotten because they are no longer under the threat of execution. They are no longer treated as a priority within the criminal justice system, and they can no longer draw upon the help of experienced legal teams, and they may not even be entitled to appeals, which we've seen a lot here in the state of Missouri. And in many cases, when people are released from death row, little or nothing is done to deal with the equal bad injustice they now face. They will have to spend the rest of their lives in prison for a crime they didn't commit. How can we do this in the land of the free, in the land of the brave? We only have an illusion of justice for some people. And it's horrifying. It's horrifying when you watch it and you experience it with your own eyes. And you've now done that. How has this book changed your life?
It has changed my life in the way, on a personal level, where I have realized how quickly a life can change for the worse because of authorities that you have trusted in or that you should be able to trust in.
That we have blind faith in, right?
Sorry?
That we have blind faith in.
Yeah. And we should be able to have that. But the thing is, with society, the surrounding society, and with authorities in many different ways, is that we count on them when we cannot count on ourselves. But if the ones that you trust in and that you believe will be there for you when you need them, when they actually turn out to be your worst enemy, you completely lose faith in society. And I would say, and I hope that I'm not being naive, but I still believe that 99% of all law enforcement officers that decide to spend their life in that way, and prosecutors, etc., I do believe, and I still do, that they try to do their best. But there are too many cases where it has not been so. And on a personal level, that has given me, how should I put it? It has led me to believe that you cannot always count on the people, even within law enforcement, as you would expect to. On another personal level, I have also naturally been very affected by meeting these people. I'm a father myself, and I have spoken to people who've been on death row who were deprived of their kids. Because when you put a person on death row, you also harm their entire family if you put an innocent person on death row. Sons and daughters, wives and husbands, they won't see the people they love for at times decades before they are proven innocent and exonerated. And meeting these people, that has been something that it goes straight to the heart. You lean back and you say, thank God this was not me. Thank God this was not a relative or a friend of mine. But if you live in the American society, you never know if it will actually be your neighbor next, if it will be your father or your daughter or whoever next, because there's so many cases of wrongful convictions, and in a worst case scenario, cases that have even led to people being exonerated on death row. Because we're not only talking about people who are there now and who will hopefully at a certain point be released if they're proven innocent. We're also talking about people that we know were innocent but exonerated after death. And these stories, they go straight to the heart. And to me, it's been important realizing but also acting on it that these people are victims. And they are victims to a degree where they often can't help themselves. Therefore, they need the help of others. And one of the purposes of writing this book is has actually been giving them a voice. And I think that's really important that we all give the innocent in prison a voice by trying to help them out.
We talked off record on some of the experiences that you came across as you put this book together. And one of the things that you came across with was how people are making a profit off people's misery and how sad that is as someone that would really like to see true change and hope for people's lives when they are innocent like this. You want to talk about that? I think that's just so gut-wrenching that we have, well, like your book, everyone that you spoke to, every single person, they wanted nothing but to be a voice for change, a voice for hope, a voice to make things better for the next person in their shoes. And as human beings, I wish we could all be that way, but we are not. Your book is an amazing book, and you wrote this book in Denmark. You live in Denmark. You are fascinated with America, and you wrote this extraordinary book, took the time to do it, and yet there's people that really are in good positions to help change things, make people's lives different. They wanted to charge you for helping you promote your book. And I found that very sad. And I just hope that in America, we can all band together and do what is right for one another. With so many exonerations, this demonstrates the great need for Americans not to have blind faith within our justice system, that we have flaws in the legal system that should be sufficient concerns to make this practice unethical. The death penalty is irreversible. Once their life is taken, there's no more appeals. And why should anything be set in concrete when you have newly discovered evidence that you didn't know about, or when you find out that evidence was literally purposely thrown away, or when you find out that someone maliciously and willfully lied, or people were actually paid to tell lies about you to have you prosecuted? No one should want that. Not one human being in America should want that. The death penalty is ineffective. It diverts attention and financial resources away from, you know, preventative measures that could actually increase public safety. And I would think that's what all of us would want. But how has promoting your book, and I know that you're also working on your on writing actual movies for this. How is all that going?
I think that, you know, everything is when it comes to creating the content is going really good, and the people that are participating in the book and with the other projects that I'm working on, they're doing, you know, an enormous effort to get this message out, and I'm very grateful. But I've also experienced, as you said, there are 10 people in the book, but I've spoken to a lot more. And one of the first surprises I had was actually when I approached people who had been exonerated after decades in prison, not all of them on death row. And I approached them and asked them to tell their stories. And the first shock I had when I got in touch with a man who has been compensated million and million and millions of dollars after being wrongfully convicted. And I think that's only fair. That's how it should be. If society steals a huge part of your life, society should pay for that, no doubt. But I was very shocked that even some of these people who have been compensated, they wanted money as well to tell their stories. And they're entitled to have that belief. But I would say, if you've been wrongfully convicted yourself and you know how difficult it is getting out, getting help, then it surprises me if you're not going to be coming straight forward, being a voice for those people who are still in the position you were. And I have also been very, I would say, shocked in the way that after releasing this book by the end of February, I've been contacted by several organizations who work to help people who are exposed to social injustice and wrongfully convicted and so on. And they've invited me on podcast shows and so on. And down the line, when we've been discussing the content and how to go about it, they have asked for money as well. And to begin with, it really shocked me. And now it really, you know, at times it really makes me mad, because other people's misery is not something you should turn into a business. And that has surprised me, how many of the organizations fighting for justice, how they in ways seem to, you know, conduct this as a business rather than helping innocent people who need them. And that has surprised me.
greed just sort of takes over everything and everyone at times. And I feel it's really important to discuss that, because here we're talking about lives. We're talking about how do you put a price on a person's life? How do you put a price on a person's freedom? How do you put a price on a person's family? When you have to lose everything, including your life, you would think more people would want to change this and would not want this to happen to another soul. And because people do make mistakes, and there's, you know, it's just part of being human, it's just a shame that we have all this little greed and power that controls a lot of our system. And part of that problem is individuals, ourselves, not just our government, but our people. People need to stand up and be a voice and do what is right, because it's simply right to do. And that's what the system should want. It shouldn't be about making a bunch of money off individuals. But unfortunately, when you study our prison, you realize it is really based on a lot of money. It's about making money. We're going to have to wrap up in like 1 minute. So I want to give you this last minute. Is there anything you would like to say to help encourage people to do the right thing? And I encourage everybody to run out, get this book, share it with attorneys, share it with judges, share it with law enforcement. It's an incredible book. It's jaw-dropping, gut-wrenching, and it just really touches your heart, goes to the heart of the matter.
Thank you very much for that. I think that the most important thing is that people, they realize what a huge problem this is, and that people realize you cannot turn the blind eye to this matter, because the people who need your help, they are people who have nothing. They have no resources. They are absolutely on their by themselves. And don't see them as people in prison. See them as innocent mothers and fathers in prison, because that's what these people are that I'm writing about. By reading this book, sharing it with others, you give them a voice. And there's actually some people that I would like to read it more than lawyers and judges and so on. And that's actually people in high schools and in colleges, because they are the future, and they are the ones that can abolish the death penalty, and making sure that we do not execute an innocent person. And you started out by a beautiful quote from the Death Penalty Information Center, but I don't see it as a small detail or a small chance that we execute an innocent person. Already there's been 164 Americans exonerated from death row. And it's believed that 4 to 5% of all prisoners on death row are innocent. So it's actually, in my opinion,
pretty
not a
huge.
Small chance.
Pretty huge.
It's a huge risk we have.
Yes. Thank you.
Of executing innocent people.
Thank you so much for coming on the show and writing this incredible, extraordinary book. And thank you for joining us, everyone.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following is taken from the Century of Lies program, a Drug Truth Network production hosted by Doug McVeigh. And though he didn't say as much, this is a Drug Truth Network editorial.
The UN's Commission on Narcotic Drugs holds its annual sessions at the UN complex in Vienna, Austria, which is the headquarters of the CND, as well as headquarters for the UN Office on Drugs and Crime and of the International Narcotics Control Board. If these meetings were being held at the UN's facility in Geneva, Switzerland, or in New York City, then there would be video and audio of the entire proceeding online, both broadcast live at the time of the meeting and available afterward in an archive. Unfortunately, the UN's drug control agencies over in Vienna seem to think that they're living in the 1960s. It's so much easier to do the work of the people, for the people, when the people can be shut out of the proceedings entirely and left in the dark. But you know, considering the catastrophic global failure that is international drug control policy, you can kind of understand where they're coming from. You know, well, that stuff don't fly with me. Whether it's policymaking or lawmaking, these sorts of proceedings need to be carried out in the open. Governments must be held accountable. Drug warriors at these meetings insist on blind obedience to a set of outdated, ill-thought-out conventions that were doomed to fail, because to do otherwise would be to admit that they were wrong. Millions of lives lost, more millions of lives ruined, all because some git in a suit with a government job can't admit that they got it wrong. Drug control policies based on prohibition and centered around punishment have consistently failed for decades. If you look at the policies, the data, the facts, then that is undeniable. That's the reason the CND doesn't keep an archive of its meetings. That's the reason why they don't video or webcast any of the many side events held during their annual meetings. That's the reason why they only do a live webcast of portions of their meeting. That's also the reason why I watch and record as much of their meetings as possible, and why I encourage everyone from civil society who's attending these meetings to do everything they can to document. Whether it's live tweeting, blogging, recording audio or video, using their smartphones, their tablets, their laptops, by every means available. The CND hates people like us, dear listener. Global drug control policy is decided in darkness and maintained through ignorance. But we can force it into the light of day. We are doing it. As I always say, the drug war is built on a foundation of lies. Those lies crumble when exposed to the light of truth.
You can hear Doug's report on UN happenings on the March 20th edition of Century of Lies. I am Dean at DrugTruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.